Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. When our next guest, Mimi Baird, was 6 years old, her father disappeared from her life.
My mother told me he just wasn't coming home. It was just, well, your father's away.
Her father was the late Dr. Perry Cossart Baird, Jr. He was a Texas-born, Harvard-educated physician, a rising star in Boston's medical community in the late 1920s and 30s. At the peak of his career, Dr. Baird's brilliant mind proved to be a tortured one. He was institutionalized for bipolar disease, or as it was then known, manic depression.
Of course, back in those days, the little said the best. And it was a universal gag factor, and that was the way most people coped with unpleasant things.
Dr. Perry Baird died when he was 56 years old from complications after he was given a lobotomy. 4 decades later, a remarkable chapter in his life story arrived on his daughter Mimi's doorstep. It was in the form of a manuscript he'd written in 1944 during one of his stays at Westboro State Hospital. The manuscript became the foundation for a book Mimi has written about her father's career and illness. It's called He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird and His Daughter's Quest to Know Him. When we spoke with Mimi Baird earlier this week, she recalled a turning point in her father's life.
The first public manic episode was in 1932, and he had a full-blown manic attack in public in New York. And because it was at a medical meeting, he lost his appointment as professor at Harvard Medical School, which was pretty devastating. As with this kind of problem, unfortunately, you cycle more and more as you get older. So he would go into various mental institutions for a little, maybe 10 days here, 2 weeks there. And then as time went on, as it got into the late 1930s, he'd have to stay longer because the episodes were more intense. This is a disease that doesn't get any better, that unfortunately gets worse and more demonstrative and more destructive.
And really that they knew very little about at the time, including the cause of it and how to treat it. The episodes your father had are written about very clearly. And maybe if you can describe just what would be typical of his manic experiences.
Our little clapboard house in Chestnut Hill had very thin walls. And when my father was in a full-blown manic attack, you'd have him come home and, you know, slam the door and turn on the Victrola, turn up the music, just completely out of control. And then, unfortunately, as we know, you cool down and you become depressed, and then you become unreasonable. If anybody crosses you, tells you not to do this, or could you please do that, he gets physical. As a child, I used to see what I thought was ketchup on the wall or ketchup on the floor or ketchup on the dining room table, but that wasn't ketchup. They can't control themselves, Lisa. They start to get angry. You can't reason with them.
And what's so contradictory about that is that to read your father's manuscript, you hear very much a different story, and that is part of the enormous value in these manuscripts. So tell us how you came about finding your father's writings, how you even knew that during that period in 1944 when he was at Westboro State Hospital, he was writing about his experience.
Well, certainly had absolutely no idea, and I was working at the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, and in the spring of 1994, I went out to Dallas, Texas on a medical meeting, and I thought, gosh, I think my father's youngest brother was alive. So I looked him up in the phone book. He came over and had tea with me at the hotel the next day. He turned to me and said, you know, your father wrote a manuscript, and my son, Randy, has it in his garage.
And it's like 11 inches tall, this onion skin paper, your dad's handwriting. And it's basically an account of what he was going through at the time. And one of the things that's really incredible about this is that through his eyes, his manic depressive episodes are told almost dispassionately. You know, when he was staying at the Ritz-Carlton and he would go there to say he was going to be writing, doing professional writing. And then he decides he wants to go out and take a walk. So he's on the Boston Common or in the public garden. And he feels so enormously exuberant. He's jumping over garden beds. He is talking to people he normally wouldn't talk with. He's doing all the things that would really draw attention to someone, let alone somebody who is this esteemed doctor who traveled in pretty affluent circles. But he writes about these things not with a sense of despair, a little bit wonderment maybe, but very straightforwardly. What did you take note of in that?
Well, I think that just showed his ability as a teacher and to step back. But we've also got to realize in reading this, and I think you've picked up on it, Lisa, that sometimes he thinks he's just fine and he's not. And that's, I think, the multi-layers, because it's pure manic in nature. What he thinks might be happening is totally different from what did happen, which is, thank goodness we have those medical records, because that proves the point.
He entitled the manuscript Echoes from a Dungeon Cell, describing the treatment that he was receiving there. And these are accurate descriptions, so far as we know, of what mental hospitals were like in those days. There are practices like being wrapped up like a mummy in ice-cold sheets in which he had to defecate because they wouldn't take him to the bathroom on regular intervals. He talks about being put in a straitjacket and talking about the canvas and the stiff canvas ribbons, and there were 16 or 18 of them, and they would be wrapped tightly to a chair so he couldn't escape. And then he would write for pages about how he would try to do a Houdini act and use his toes to extract himself from the chair. Give us an example of one of those things that he wrote about that then, when you found the hospital records, you found them quite different telling of what was going on.
Well, the classic one to me is when he's standing by the window in his room, and I get, you know, it's springtime and there are some birds flying around the trees next to his window, and he starts whistling to pass the time, and he thinks he can communicate with the birds. He says, well, I was whistling at these beautiful birds, and, you know, all of a sudden the glass of the window started to shatter. Now, goodness, how did that happen? I was so embarrassed, and I helped the staff clean up the glass, the shattered glass on the floor. Then you turn to the medical record of that particular day, and you find that he was in a manic state and completely destroyed his room, completely. And he was very strong. He bent the bed. He took the material around the window and just pulled it out of its frame. And if you take that example of what he did in his room, you can imagine what it was like at home.
So when you read your father's account and the hospital's account, the first time especially that you read them, what was it like for you?
Well, it was, you know, really horrifying. And it made me realize what I had absorbed as a young child and what was stored, you know, in my cellular memory. And I guess it was validating to a degree that made me understand why he wasn't home anymore. It's an awful lot to understand and comprehend and apply to yourself personally, and then to think that your father was that ill. I mean, that's just dreadful, dreadful.
And he is so aware in some cases, and obviously not others, about what he's going through, and held himself as this man who had very high-placed friends, and the family was a member of the country club in Chestnut Hill, a very exclusive club. And he writes in the manuscript, when he was at Westfield, "My dignity as a prominent practicing physician seemed to have been violated flagrantly. I felt insulted." And which is very painful to think that was going on with him, and that knowing that he would reach out to friends and they supposedly wouldn't return his phone calls or his letters, maybe in some cases some did, but they were afraid of him. There is one part of the manuscript that is very telling, and I wonder if you would read it for us. This begins at the bottom of page 56 and presents what seems to be very clear insight into the circumstances he was facing.
Yeah, this is after he comes off of a period of harsh treatment, and this is a very poignant paragraph. I pray to God that in the future I shall be able to remember that once one has crossed the line from the normal walks of life into a psychopathic hospital, one is separated from friends and relatives by walls thicker than stone, walls of prejudice and superstition. It may be hoped that psychopathic hospitals will someday become a refuge for the mentally ill and a place where they may hope to recover through channels of wise and gentle care. But the modern psychopathic hospitals I have known are direct descendants of ancient jails like Bedlam, and I believe that they do harm, not good.
That's Mimi Baird reading from her father's own account of the time that he spent at Westboro State Hospital back in 1944, one of several institutionalizations that he went through because of a diagnosis of manic depression. You know, one of the things about this passage also is that it's chilling because it was written 70 years ago, yet those words that he uses about prejudice and superstition are words that could be used about mental illness today and how to care for the mentally ill in this country. What does that say to you, Mimi?
It's just so awful to think of what the environment in those hospitals was like back then. It's awful to think of one that's from your own family having to endure those experiences. And 99% of the time, your actions you cannot help because that's your biochemical, as we know now, biochemical makeup.
And your dad, that's part of the great value of these manuscripts, is that your dad suspected that this was not an emotional disease, that there was a biochemical foundation to what he was going through.
Exactly. It's just so thrilling. I mean, this is another level of it. Here he's experiencing his problem, but he actually succeeds in having his preliminary work on this hypothesis published while he was in Westboro.
And what did his writings and his research, what has it contributed to the field?
Well, you see, this is the thing that's going to be so interesting. After he was published, his research was forgotten. He was forgotten. Everything was forgotten. And nobody wanted to remember him because he was so, you know, unfortunately unmanageable. So you see, until this book has been published, nobody knew that my father had written this. So I'm trying to resurrect my father's work and reputation for medical history, which is a very, very exciting thing.
And I guess that's probably one of the ways maybe you were able to get through publishing this manuscript, knowing that there was something, well, maybe a lot that your father would be proud of in here.
Oh, my gosh, yes. He felt so strongly that we needed education, we needed awareness, we needed to know more about how this all works so that people could try and defray their immediate prejudice on anybody who was acting any way other than normal. And that, you know, that was his objective. He was always a teacher.
Mimi Baird is the daughter of the late Dr. Perry Cassart Baird Jr. and author of the new book called He Wanted the Moon, The Madness and Medical Genius of Dr. Perry Baird. Thank you so much for talking with us and sharing your dad's story too, Mimi.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you for being so compassionate.